Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., all rights reserved.
And now, back to a man who didn't let being named one of the 100 most important radio talk show hosts in America go to his head.
Woo! Woo! Yes! In your face!
He's Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate.
We're back. It's 34 after the hour. Thanks for joining us. If you just tuned in, welcome aboard. My website is www.jbsba.com. Lots of things you can do there, including listen to over 2,000 archives of historic shows that we've done in the past, including the ones we did yesterday or the day before. And also, you can read articles there by many members of our Brain Trust and by me as well. And you can subscribe to my free newsletter when you get there, too. Bert Folsom is our guest. Bert is the author of a couple of outstanding books, at least two that I know of, Empire Builders, How Michigan Entrepreneurs Helped Make America Great, and The Myths of the Robber Barons. And he is a professor at Hillsdale College in Michigan, and he's our good friend. He's also the resident historian of the Small Business Advocate Show. Bert, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Jim. Always it's good to be here.
It's good to have you back. Bert, I asked Bert to join us today to talk to us a little bit about the history of conventions, of political conventions, and how they got their start. And Bert, I guess the best place to start is to go back and begin with the seeds of what would have caused the conventions. And I guess we'd have to go back to the late 18th century, and when the presidential elections were chosen by congressional caucuses.
Yes, that would be a place to trace the origins. The first actual convention that would be recognizable to people as a modern convention would be the ones that were held in the 1830s, when you actually had delegates there. They actually were meeting in a central place and actually nominating candidates.
Well, the people felt that the caucuses took too much of the power out of their hands, didn't they?
Yes, and of course they did, because they were strictly, as you said, congressional caucuses.
Right.
But when you have parties where each state has representatives and where they select a candidate at a nominating convention, we get that with Andrew Jackson and, actually the Anti-Masonic Party was the
mm-hmm.
first one.
Right.
But then you get Andrew Jackson in 1832 being a critical election where everybody then, the major parties, began to move in that direction.
Right. And then that's really what gave rise to the solidifying of political parties, because prior to that convention, the party system had really kind of fallen apart a little bit. And as I remember, there actually, prior to that 1832, like in the 1820s, there was really just one strong political party, which was called the Democrat hyphen Republican Party, which is kind of a funny duck. Would have to be kind of a funny. By the way, according to my research, Bert, that party had nothing to do with the modern day Republican or Democrat Party.
Right. There's some ironies there, aren't there? James Monroe won almost unanimously in 1820 when he was running for re-election. The Federalist Party had dropped by the wayside after 1816. And then in 1824, you even had four candidates running on this one party.
Mm-hmm.
So, we went through a period of fluctuation between our first party system with the Federalists and the Jeffersonians, and then the second party system, which ultimately was going to be with the Democrats and the Whigs.
Right. Well, and so when the conventions came into vogue, which was around 1832, I guess you said, then it really kind of helped the convention process to solidify the concept of political parties and help them to define themselves, didn't it?
It did. And, of course, political parties were shunned by the founders. They didn't think political parties were a good idea. And the idea of two major political parties is increased by the Electoral College, which, of course, is a winner-take-all system with the states, and you have to get over half of the electoral votes to win. So that helps move us toward a two-party system, and then these conventions come in with the Democrats and the Whigs after the decline of that first-party system, and we're underway with something that would be a little recognizable to our modern people by the 1830s and 1840s.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think the the founders didn't like the political party idea. You think they just didn't it was something they just didn't really understand? It hadn't at that point in time, at the end, during the founding days, there really weren't there wasn't a lot of, there wasn't much history there, was there?
No. Now they had the English, and they were not impressed with the way the English party system worked because they saw it as being divisive to the country. They saw people putting party interests ahead of national interests, and all of that is true. All of that is true. But they believed that you ultimately could reach a national consensus, or at least some of the founders, that you could reach more of a national consensus. And so the idea of a party system with fragmenting loyalties and that kind of divisiveness was repugnant to them.
Hold on to that thought, Bert Folsom. We're going to take a quick break, folks. We'll be right back with Bert Folsom. And we're going to move a little bit more into the current age with political conventions and get some more thoughts from our good friend Bert Folsom. Stay with us. We're back at 17 till. I'm Jim Blasingame, Small Business Advocate. We're visiting with Bert Folsom, Professor of History at Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan. And we've known Bert a long time. Back when we knew him first when he was with the Mackinac Center, and then he moved to Texas with the Center for the American Idea. And now he's back to teaching again, which I'm very excited about. Bert, I'm so happy that America's youth has an opportunity to hear you every day.
Well, it's nice of you to say that.
I think the world is a better place because of that.
Well, thank you, Jim. Hillsdale is a fun place to teach, and we get good students, and we believe in the limited government philosophy because Hillsdale takes no federal aid.
And that makes it easier on the teaching staff because you don't have to fill out any government forms, right?
You're exactly right. It means that we can run the college can be run the way we think it ought to be run, not the way the federal government thinks we ought to operate it.
You know, in terms of just about everywhere else in the world, in the United States, Hillsdale College is a little brigadoon, isn't it? It sort of just pops up out of the mist every 100 years. Hey, Bert, let's get back into our conversation about political conventions. Okay, so the political conventions so we can thank the political convention process for really creating what has become a two-party system. It gave people who had different ideas about how things should be run a place to go. It gave them a home, and they knew once a year they were going to be able to get together and whoop it up on behalf of people who think like they do.
Right, and by 1840, you know, we're talking about the 1830s, you know, we had that Tippecanoe and Tyler II campaign where you get slogans,
right.
You get people yelling and shouting and having lots of activity at the convention, lots of the delegates getting excited. And the convention sometimes can even make a difference. Remember, Abraham Lincoln in 1860 was nominated in Chicago, Illinois. The convention was in Chicago. And he was a dark horse, but you had that in his home state, and you were able to generate a certain amount of sentiment for Lincoln,
right.
In part because it was right in the man's home state. So
mm-hmm.
Even the location can sometimes make a difference and help a candidate or hurt another one.
Well, see, that's one of the things that I think I wonder about the convention this week in Massachusetts, in Boston. You know, right now, not to bring us too quickly to the future, but I mean to the present, Bert. But right now, since you brought that up, you know, the gay marriage issue is very much front and center in this political season, and of course,
yeah.
Massachusetts is the poster child for that issue because of what the Massachusetts Supreme Court did.
Yes, it is interesting. It may not be a good move by the Democrats to have had that had their convention in Boston. We'll just have to see. The conventions used to not be automatic on who they would select. In other words, because of the primary system and the way the primary system has worked in the 20th century, the delegates after 1952 have all been. They know who's going to win by the time you have the convention, but that didn't used to be the case. I mean, that's in the last 50 years. But in the example of Abraham Lincoln that I gave earlier, he was a dark horse, and there was no strong odds at all that he would be the nominee. So that those kinds of issues, where you have the convention and what that signifies.
So in those days, the convention was a very important step in the whole process, the electoral process, whereas today it's basically nothing more than a pep rally.
Yes, that's right, and that's why the
for both parties
the TV networks are reluctant to cover the conventions from the beginning to the end anymore, because that's exactly what it is. There are no longer any surprises.
When was the last time there was a surprise in a political convention, or the possibility of some kind of a change in the direction? Would it have been Reagan and Ford in 76?
Maybe, except that Ford had the delegates. Ford barely had enough delegates, and so sometimes you get a surprise over who the vice presidential nominee will be, but to have a surprise over the presidential nominee, you have to go back to Stevenson in 1952, when Kefauver came in with more delegates than Stevenson, and Stevenson ended up on the third ballot winning the nomination. That's the last time that happened, 1952.
But didn't Reagan challenged Ford from an incumbent standpoint, the party in the White House. Reagan challenged Ford in 76, and if I'm not mistaken, Kennedy challenged Carter in 80.
Yes, that's right, but neither of them had won enough delegates in the primaries to come into the convention.
So when they came into the convention, there was no question about who was going to be nominated.
Exactly.
That's the part I'd forgotten.
In both cases, you gave Ford had slightly over 50% of the delegates in 76.
Right.
And in 1980, Carter had really quite a few more delegates than Kennedy. There was no question; it was over by the time the convention.
What do you think? What do you think about that? Do you think it's a good thing to have all this decided before the convention, or do you think we'd be better off if the convention meant more?
It can work both ways, but I'll tell you this: it just depends on whether you want to have voters select the nomination. It was the nominee early, and it's always been early, more often than not, in a couple key primaries, or do you want your major politicians and a few others to try to work out who would be the best candidate
in the smoke-filled room, the infamous smoke-filled rooms?
The infamous smoke-filled room turned out some pretty good candidates, though, over the year, too.
Stand by, Bert. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with our good friend Bert Folsom, the author of Empire Builders and The Myth of the Rubber Barons. 10 till. Stay with us.
Lights close the tired eyes. I'll soon be with you, my love.
We're back at 7 till. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate. We're visiting with our good friend Bert Folsom. Burton W. Folsom Jr. is the author of Empire Builders and The Myth of the Rubber Barons. Both of those are still available. One of them has been recently re-released as another edition, hasn't it, Bert?
Right. Thank you, Jim. Yes, Myth of the Rubber Barons is now in its fourth edition.
Fourth edition. So, congratulations, Bert.
Thank you.
Bert, we're going to hear Thursday night, we're going to hear John Kerry make his speech, his acceptance speech. And probably the same time during the week George Bush will make his in about a month or so. Now, there was a time, though, when the nominees, if they were the obvious nominees, didn't even show up for the convention.
You're exactly right. That shows a change, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Franklin Roosevelt was the first candidate to actually visit the convention and come in there and give a speech like that. He did it in 1932 when he flew into, I think it was in Chicago. He went from New York to Chicago, flew right in for the Democratic Convention. But see, he won on the third ballot. He didn't know he was going to be the nominee. Al Smith put up a good fight.
Right.
But he was listening on radio. See, the radio had made a difference by then. So he knew he was the nominee. The Democrats in 1924 had a convention that went 103 ballots before they got a nominee.
Wow.
And then it was an obscure lawyer named John Davis, who hardly anybody had heard of.
Mm-hmm.
So it was sensible in a way for somebody not to show up, because it was a surprise sometimes who the nominee was.
Hmm.
But Roosevelt showed up in 1932, and the candidates have done so ever since.
the primary system has basically taken the fun out of the conventions, hasn't it, in a lot of ways?
Yes, it did. And remember, the primary started out with just a few primaries, and we didn't get just about every state involved until the last 20 or 30 years. But it used to be just a few states had primaries, New Hampshire, of course, being one of the early ones. But then the verdict that the primaries were coming up with often went against what the convention delegates wanted, the leading political people in the party. And so there you have the conflict that went throughout the 20th century on who's going to prevail, the party leaders or the voters in the party.
But, you know, Bert, when you say, you know, somebody might say, well, it's better that the people get to decide. But the truth is, there's really only about, in most cases, in most years, most election years, there's only about four or five states that actually do make a difference. Iowa, New Hampshire, maybe South Carolina, and what else? I've forgotten what else. But the thing is,
you're making a very good point.
Is often it's over by the time most of us get to vote.
In effect, that's exactly what happened. It disfranchises just about everybody except for the voters in Iowa and New Hampshire. And sometimes you get some other states involved, like Florida has an early primary sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But
this year,
it's Iowa and New Hampshire, and it's over.
Well, see,
I think that's
a mistake. I mean, I don't think those. Yeah. I've been to Iowa and New Hampshire, and I like those folks, but I don't think they deserve to be able to decide who's going to be the president, who's going to be the nominee, I should say.
In effect, that's the way it's worked out. It was never planned that way by the people who advocated primaries in the progressive era. 1912 was the first election you had presidential primary.
Right.
There were only seven of them, and I believe it was seven, but a very small number. But they never. It was never expected that those people would actually be dictating who the nominee would be.
Right.
Or later that these two little states would determine who the nominee. So there's no. I think you make a very very good point. There is no reason to believe that what is being done today is really a better way to select candidates than what was done.
It disenfranchises, you know, basically as many people in a lot of ways. It has a potential not to disenfranchise people, but the result typically is that it does. It disenfranchises people in all of the late primaries. Let me ask you this question: Are you going to listen to Mr. Kerry's speech on Thursday?
Oh yes.
What do you think we're going to hear from him?
Well, these nominating speeches have become really boilerplate now, and what you'll see is appeal to different constituencies, I think. You will see Kerry try to reach out and say, hey, I'm going to be friendly to a small business. I don't know if he'll mention that name, but he will say something like, I want to be friendly. He will make some statement like, I want to be friendly to entrepreneurs or people.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be a little something for everybody. This will be a homogenized speech that will not be very exciting, but it will try not to alienate anybody. It will couch controversial issues in smooth terms. It will probably not be much of substance.
Well, we'll look for that, and we'll think about you when we listen to John Kerry speak. Bert, thank you for being here today. It's always a pleasure.
Jim, thank you.
See you
Enjoy
next time.
Show.
Bert Folsom, ladies and gentlemen, the resident historian of the Small Business Advocate Show, joining us to talk to us about conventions. Don't forget his new book is actually the re-release of his book in the fourth edition, The Myth of the Robber Barons by Bert Folsom. I got to go for this hour. I'm Jim Blasingame. Don't go away. I'll be right back.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.